When you say come here, this is a poem by Rachel Happen. When you say come here, notice the movements in your body that happen when you make this request, whether your hand, head, or chin make a little tug. Look around. Where exactly do you want them? Is there a seat you have in mind or a place on the floor? Or do you just want them within the reach of your voice or the reach of your arm? Where is here? Move yourself slightly to one side or the other, and notice if the desired here shifts as well. If you can, move a little further and notice how you can carry here with you. Wherever you go, you are a place called here. See if you can leave here like a coin on the ground and walk away. Look back at that place and say, as though homesick for here, I want to be here. What happens as you say this? Consider how, when you point at a map, your fingertip becomes here. Look straight up. How far up do you consider here? How far underground could something be and still be here? Bring back your sense of here, right where you are. Could it be that here is the best and only place you've ever been? How could you thank here for showing you everything you've ever seen? For bringing you every smell, every sound, every taste, every feeling. Could here be your true home? Could here be just like your body, a part of you, inseparable from you? Could here actually be your body? Like your body, it mediates everything you've ever experienced. It cannot exist without you. Look very closely. What is the difference between here and you?
Hi, everybody, both in the room and online. Thank you for being here tonight. I forgot when I did my talk on Saturday to thank Norman for the chance to do talks. This is quite an amazing and unpredictable event that we get to sit here and talk to all of you and be with you in this way. So, as you know, we're studying Dogen this month, which means for some of us, we are living in the conclusion, I don't get this. He's too hard and illogical, contradicting himself in every other line. People like Norman get him, and sometimes when Norman says something that I understand, I hold on to it for a few minutes, but then I forget. Maybe when we say we don't get Dogen, we mean we can't explain it to anyone else, or we can't find our own experience, in our own experience, what he's talking about. Or we don't know what to do, what we're supposed to do, with what we are hearing or reading from him. Is it some strange acquired taste that some people enjoy, like eating food from a different culture? Maybe hearing about him again, we tense, like we tense our mouth when we think we're going to bite into something that we aren't going to like. Perhaps we've gotten into the habit of learning to put up with the Dogen part and join in with other people who agree with that view. Let's see if we can come to a more friendly orientation to Dogen. He's not so much trying to tell us something as to give us a chance to learn how we listen to things. He's not so much up to showing us something as giving us a way to appreciate how we are seeing. We have a way of reading, studying, and listening that is immediate and effortless. We are not usually aware that we learn these skills. Our perception has a design function, which is not to contact reality, but to bring our attention to what's necessary for us to be safe, connect to others in the way that we want. Dogen keeps pointing out this design function, and we easily get caught. Miss his point because he doesn't help us be safe, connect with others, solve our problems, and so on. It's kind of like going to a big museum, and maybe, I don't know about everybody here, but maybe everyone here at some point has gone to a big museum. And we're walking through the galleries, and we're seeing the Monets. We're seeing the Van Goghs. Oh, they're so beautiful. Georgia O'Keeffe, isn't she amazing? And the sculpture of Ruth Osawa. Wow, how did she do that? And then we keep walking, and we come up to a urinal signed Our Mutt by Marcel Duchamp, and a pile of industrial pipes installed according to the instructions of Eva Hesse. We readily say, I don't get this part. Why are they calling this art? Why are these pieces here? I don't like them. They don't speak to me. They are not beautiful. No, really, why are they here? How do you respond when you see such things? I think the last two artists might be reminding us that we always already, in microseconds, are pushing something away or bringing it close in. We are doing that. The artwork isn't. Can we catch this process happening? That's one of the things that we can learn from artists. We might be able to do the same thing with Dogen. Notice what we immediately push away. Tighten our body, mind, and heart in reaction to something that seems so foreign or in some way not for us. Let's see what happens when we relax instead. Perhaps in that spaciousness, we can become aware of our reaction and warmly welcome it in, and ready a place to receive what is being pointed out by someone who cares deeply about us, even though he lived long ago and far away. Softening our body opens our mind as the whole field in which perception and reality arrive for us. Here's a bit more about Dogen's orientation from a different angle. The deep background, which is paradoxically always pressing in on us, for all of Buddhist teaching is entropy, the second law of thermodynamics. Simply stated, it says, closed systems will inevitably become disorganized, chaotic over time. It flows one way. That which is disorganized does not get reorganized on its own. One classic example is spraying perfume into a room. It doesn't come back into the bottle on its own. Maybe you've noticed the same phenomena on your desk, which somehow on its own gets disorganized, unless we make a concerted effort to keep it orderly. Another way of talking about entropy is everything will drift to a lower energy state without intervention. I think this plays out in awareness and presence. Unless we actively intervene, that is, practice, we drift out of being aware of our surroundings, our experience, our connection to others, and the wider circle of life. We lose our presence and become repetitive and mechanical in how we speak, think, and act. It requires energy to consciously, creatively respond, and much less energy to react, because reactivity takes much less active brain engagement. For its size, as you might know, the brain uses many more calories than any other organ. Diminishing its use strengthens our chances of survival. Buddha and his disciples did not have scientific observations and mathematical formulas, nor the word entropy, which was brought to us in the 19th century, to explain the dissipation of everything around them, including human life. They brought us anicca in Pali, anitya in Sanskrit, translated into English as impermanence. Yes. That was a little quiz I dropped into the middle of my talk. Referring to the same immutable fact of material existence. We aren't doing something wrong, aren't morally culpable when our life becomes messy, disorganized. That is what happens when we aren't paying attention, practicing. Probably all of us know in our own way what I'm speaking about, yet we so easily forget, which is part of entropy, impermanence. The truth of entropy gets validated every day in what we observe or actively avoid, feel or suppress from awareness. Our being caught by entropy includes all the strong habits, ready answers, cliched ways of speaking, holding desperately to past insights that we don't experience in body in the moment, and one of my favorites, imitating others who seem to be succeeding. There are many Zen stories on this point, and you might even know them. They might be readily available to you, but here's one that our friend Dogen tells in the Bendawa. Long ago, Gensoku was the director monk in the assembly of the Zen master Hogen. Hogen asked him, "Director Gensoku, how long have you been in my assembly?" Gensoku replied, "I have already been in the master's assembly for 3 years." Hogen said, "You are a student. Why haven't you ever asked me about Buddha Dharma?" I guess teachers are paying attention even when we think we're just blending in. That's not in Dogen, that's from me. Gensoku said, "I cannot deceive you, old teacher. Once, when I was at Zen Master's Seho's place, I realized the peace and joy of Buddha Dharma." Hogen asked, "With which words were you able to enter?" Gensoku responded, "I once asked Seho, what is the self of the student, that is, my own self? Seho said, the fire boy comes seeking fire." Hogen said, "Good words. However, I'm afraid that you did not really understand them." Gensoku said, "My understanding is that the fire boy belongs to fire." Already fire, still he seeks fire, just like being self and seeking self. Let me read that because I lost my place. So Gensoku said, "My understanding is that the fire boy belongs to fire. Already fire, still he seeks fire, just like being self and seeking self." Hogen exclaimed, "Now I really know that you don't understand. If Buddha Dharma was like that, it would not need to have been transmitted to us today." At this, Gensoku was overwrought and left immediately. On the road, he thought, "The master is one of the world's fine teachers and also the guiding teacher of 500 people. Certainly there must be merit in his pointing out my error." He returned to Hogen and after doing prostrations and repentance asked, "What is the self of this student?" Hogen said, you know what he said. You could predict what he said. Yes. Hogen said, the fire boy comes seeking fire." With these words, Gensoku was greatly enlightened to Buddha Dharma. One of those confounding stories. At first. But maybe it's holding on desperately to some insight that we had before that we're not experiencing and not embodying right now. In his commentary on this case, Dogen says, "From the time you first meet a good teacher, just genuinely inquire about the manners and standards for practice. Single-mindedly engage in the way of Zazen and do not keep your mind stuck on a single knowledge or half comprehension. The wondrous method of Buddha is not without meaning." by the way, we may well have found a good teacher, because he writes in his essay, No Teachers of Zen, from his collection, When You Greet Me, I Bow. The fundamental trust is the magic of the teacher-student relationship, and is, I think, the goal of the practice. It is liberation itself. Having confidence in someone whom we look toward as an example, an inspiration in coming to trust that person completely, even when they seem not to be cooperating with our idea about who they should be. I don't think that's ever actually happened. I think that's fantasy on Norman's part. Which means we've all had moments when we look at our teacher and say, huh? Even when they seem not to be cooperating with our idea about who they should be and how they should behave, and even when they make mistakes. Is the path toward deep trust and confidence all, it's a long sentence. So to remind you, it starts with, even though all that's happening, it's still the path towards deep trust and confidence in ourselves, our true selves, and in this life, no matter what happens, no matter what life brings. In the end, teacher and student are fluid roles, positions, not persons. Sometimes the student is the teacher, and sometimes the teacher is the student. In the Soto Zen Dharma transmission ceremony, this reality is ritually enacted. And in Zen lineage charts, the red line of succession goes from Buddha down through the generations of teachers to the present disciple, and then back up to Buddha. So each one of us, when we find our feet in the Dharma, are not only the teacher of our teacher, but the teacher of Buddha and his successors. Such radical independence, which is identical with interdependence, for our true self is no self and all selves, is what both student and teacher hold as their common treasure. You, those of us who've done Jukai, we got these papers that, first of all, they were folded in some extraordinary way that I have to tell you has kept me from ever opening them again. But when I opened it, Victoria Austin, who is one of my sewing teachers, came to my Jukai. And she's very brave and very competent, so she opened it and showed me. And it is so amazing to see Buddha's name, and then I think it was 92 generations of people coming down to me. Whoa. I am included. You are included. And then it goes the other way, as Norman said. So whoever we are is already a teacher, already and always a student at the same time. No, that's, I guess it's one of the questions in my talk is, are we willing to be, are we willing to let Dogen teach us? Or is he behaving in a way that we don't quite like or don't quite get? Or if he knew me, he would say it so much simpler. Here's a story from my own life on the same topic. Some of you know, some of you might know this. I think this was even in my way seeking mind talk. Here's another parenthesis. It occurred to me in writing this talk that every talk that someone does is their way seeking mind talk. Really, they're showing you their life, showing you their heart, showing you what they feel is worthy of attention. So, I was raised Catholic and I was a very pious boy. You might not know it from my sarcasm, but I was a very pious Catholic boy in Massachusetts, going to Catholic school even. So, I was a pious boy, feeling pulled towards something real and true and looking for it everywhere. In March 1965, it was Lent, the 40 days of repentance, self-examination, and penance Catholics do in preparation for the most important day on the church calendar, Easter. But I also have to say, I was disillusioned by my local parish priests who were well-meaning and not deep practitioners. I would say now, as I would say now, they were mostly only repeating what they had heard. During Lent that year, I pledged to go to Mass every day. The closest place turned out to be a Capuchin monastery, an order of Franciscan monks. They sang so beautifully, and when after Mass, one of them came up and looked me directly in the eye and shook my hand, I knew I was encountering someone who was living, who was in the middle of what he was preaching about. Someone living a life enveloped in practice and surrounded by fellow practitioners. Those monks had found a way to pray, meditate, chant, do sacred reading, perform rituals, so they stayed vibrant and alive, not falling into the hollow mechanistic trances we get pulled into by entropy. The title of Dogen's essay we're studying, in my favorite English translation, is The Wholehearted Way. China, where he had his big awakening, already had a 5,000-year understanding of the two aspects of the heart, which in Chinese medicine is an energetic function and a generalized location, and not simply a muscular pump in the center of our heart pumping blood. Beginning with the foundational text, the Yellow Emperor's Inner Canon, they taught the heart was the receptor for each person's mandate from heaven. Our heart is the receptor of our individual mandate from heaven. From what we would call primordial emptiness, of what was theirs to do, the deep intelligence guiding them towards what was most real and authentic, probably synonymous with the Dharma. This guidance, already there and always there, is accessed through sitting and listening to the profound silence of the heart. The second power of the heart is aligning all the other energetic systems in our life, in our body, with the mandate from heaven. All suffering ends when these two elements function fully. First, listening for, looking for, letting ourselves be directed by compassionate intelligence beyond our individual experience. And then integrating all aspects of our life in fulfillment of this call. In this space of responsive living, our attachments lose their gripping power, and our resistance to what's happening melts away. Can we find and live this wholehearted way? Dogen wrote this essay so you and I could find that way. He makes his huge claims and extravagant promises for the efficacy of practice to draw our attention away from our whole body mind project of fighting entropy by living in an habitual state in which we think, speak, and act within a narrow range, or the opposite, attempting to evade entropy by having wild adventures, checking off that bucket list, variety for its own sake, or the third alternative, nearly collapsing into a low energy, disorganized life. And maybe all of us have been in those different places at different moments. So he's making all these extravagant claims about practice, knowing that we fall into those things, because let's face it, compared to the 70 millimeter IMAX feel of everyday 21st century life, practice seems like a 10 inch black and white television with a fuzzy picture far away in the back corner. The first number of years of practice are about settling our body mind enough so we can feel, sense the whispering of our heart. The first number of years of practice are about sensing our body mind enough so we can feel, sense, hear the whispering of our heart. The more we tune in, the clearer it gets. The warmth, love in the whispering feels more welcoming, more of a homecoming than we knew was possible. And so alive. Here's what the contemporary Zen teacher in our lineage, Christian Dillo, in his wondrous book, The Path of Aliveness, has to say about it. Do you need to do something? Okay. Do you want to talk to them?
No, it's a half. I want to go take it.
Okay. It's totally fine. So this is something that Christian Dillo wrote in his great book, The Path of Aliveness. Christian Dillo is a long-term monk in Colorado. So he's a student of Richard Baker. And his book is really spectacular. It has the most distilled version of the Dharma and how to practice, especially with our body. that I've read in a long time. So here's what he has to say about listening to the whispering of our body. As I have mentioned before, the assumption in all yogic practices, including Zen, is that all mental phenomena have a bodily component and vice versa. Should I read that sentence again? Yes. 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 I know it's sometimes easier to see it, to get it when it's in print. So as I've mentioned before, the assumption in all yogic practices, including Zen, is that all mental phenomena have a bodily component and vice versa. Okay. So, what is the bodily component of this field of mind? The buzz of basic aliveness permeates the body from head to toe. The most subtle layer of this buzz of basic aliveness can be considered the feel of mind. It gets easily overshadowed by the busyness of consciousness, all sorts of proprioceptive disturbances, such as agitation or numbness. So typically, we need the practice of meditation, of not moving, stillness, not scratching, non-reactivity, and not inviting our thoughts to tea, non-thinking. Once we have noticed the field of mind through its own field, it will continue, our awareness will continue naturally. It will become readily accessible in each gap between thoughts, as the sound of silence in the darkness when we close our eyes, in the still presence of our body. Life resists entropy, disorder, running down into lower energy states. When we turn towards life, know it as ourselves, we begin to feel the joy, expansiveness, equanimity, belonging that Dogen speaks about. This is a personal project. Each of us has to do it on our own. No one else can do it for us. Being wholehearted means no holding back. No exceptions, no fenced off areas away from practice. When we begin to include everything in that orientation, it becomes grateful receiving of everything that comes along. And what we meet and who we meet become occasions for practice and opportunities to express the fruits of practice, generosity, patience, joyful effort, nonviolent caring, diligence, wisdom. Our personality, though, is endlessly crafty. You may have seen that yourself from time to time. Our personality is endlessly creative. When we aren't paying attention, we drift. We forget. Self-deception is a daily event. The remedy, objective truth-telling, is essential. And it's one of the reasons having a relationship with a teacher is central in our practice. And also why daily practice, where and when we encounter the truth of our bodily experience, is irreplaceable. Maybe we can keep letting Dogen inspire us into that. So as always, the poets among us say it best. So I'm going to read a poem of Pearls from her new book. This gorgeous cover, which is a mirror of how beautiful her poetry is. It's called My Upalavana Banana. How do you say it? Upalavana, right. Who is one of the early disciples of Buddha. Here's what Pearl says. This poem's called Buckeye. I was a girl when you loved me. Away I went into the sunset, into a letter, the shape of luck. There was some crying, sound awash in yellow. I know, over and over I know, the rhyme, the chime, because don't resist, just renounce. You don't have to walk about the past with a big jacket. Now it is now, and you announce your guilty face. Read it aloud. Your life lonely, wild with berries, blown through and through with cold wind. It wears you like a cape. You wear your cape of human skin and dried leaves. I reach for it. I try to open my hand. There's me rocking. There the leaves are falling. Suddenly the blue sky and time running across and below, spontaneous repose. I'm going to read it again, called Buckeye. I was a girl when you loved me. Away I went into the sunset, into a letter, the shape of luck. There were some crying, sound awash in yellow. I know over and over, I know the rhyme, the chime, because don't resist, just renounce. You don't have to walk about the past with a big jacket. Now it is now, and you announce your guilty face. Read it aloud. Your life lonely, wild with berries, blown through and through with cold wind. It wears you like a cape. You wear your cape of human skin and dried leaves. I reach for it. I try to open my hand. There's me rocking. There the leaves are falling. Suddenly, the blue sky and time running across and below, spontaneous repose. So thank you, Pearl. I don't know how you get this book, but its publisher is Lavender Ink Publisher. You can find it directly from the publisher, Jeff tells us. So Lavender Ink is the publisher. You can get it there. I'm sorry?
IMK, Lavender Ink.
Lavender Ink, yes. They're being clever. It's not Lavender Incorporated, it's Lavender Ink, as in what we write with Lavender Ink. Thank you. So that's my talk. Thank you very much for listening. And before we go into our groups, some people, especially online, leave. It's unusual for people in person to leave, but we never know. So I wanted to invite you to do some homework. It has two parts. You can take up one part or both parts. The first part is in your sitting. In your sitting, after you're settled for 1 or 2 minutes, let the awareness that's in your head, the place from which we often think we are experiencing things from. Let it sink down your throat, down your chest, into the middle of your heart. So bring all of your presence and awareness in your heart, into your heart, and observe and experience everything from there. See what happens. The second something you can take on is to notice where your wholeheartedness is limited. Where don't you bring wholeheartedness? Like those stupid drivers or those people who, or me. I'm so stupid. How did I forget that? Why do I keep making that mistake? Or, this is just business. The Dharma is really good, but come on, let's be in the real world. I'm just coming up with examples off the top of my head. If you look, you may find parts of your life that have been fenced off, that we keep fenced off, that you keep fenced off from the Dharma. And next week, maybe there'll be a chance to check in to see what happened. Before we move on to the groups, does anybody have a question about what I'm asking you to take up as homework? No. Okay. So we're going to do groups of three. You're going to have an especially good group tonight. The two people who are with you, we've curated this, so it's going to be really a good experience for you. There's an online question. Hi, Heidi. Can you let me talk to her, Lenny, for a second?
She's muted. Or
yeah. Yeah. Go ahead. Okay. Go ahead, Heidi.
Would you repeat those two questions again and say that slowly, please?
Yes. Happy to. The first one is is to modify our usual sitting practice. After 1 or 2 minutes of settling, let's consciously move our awareness and presence in our head. Most of us imagine that we are experiencing from our head, and let it sink through your throat, through your chest, into the middle of your heart. So as much of your consciousness and presence as possible is in your heart, and experience and attend to your sitting from there. Second part you can take up if you'd like is to notice all the places in your life that is shielded off from practice. Where are you withholding? Where are you holding back? Where are you not being wholehearted? Was that clear enough, Heidi?
Yeah, that's better, thank you.
You're welcome, thank you.